Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another edition of the New Africa Black Belt Wall, New Africa and Black Belt Wall Street Business Association. We're speaking to you live here from Washington, D.C. I am your host, Bilal Masadiq Bynum, along with my co-host.
Abdul Aziz Shaheed and Assalamu alaikum, Brother Bilal, and greetings.
Well, I guess not, Brother Aziz. How are you this evening? How are you feeling?
Oh, brother, I'm hanging on in there. I was telling you, you know, I had that dental surgery and
had my side
of my jaw swole up, but I'm okay. I deal with it.
All right, well, we're going to...
How you doing? How'd your dental come out?
I'm still, I can talk, my mouth was a little numb, but
mm-hmm.
Like I said, we'll get through this show, and hopefully we will create some new business. I need new business.
Yes.
Business spirit, but again, those of you who join in, whether it's by telephone or by internet, Brother Aziz, why don't you let them know how they can access us, and I'll leave that one on.
Absolutely. The New Africa Business Association, Black Belt Wall Street, we're on every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And our call-in number, for those that want to call in and reach us by phone, it's 657-383-1372. Or if you want to listen to us on the internet, it will be blogtalkradio.com/NABASSC. Or you can go and check our, if you want to contact us by email, you can go to the New Africa BA at gmail.com, or go to our website at newafricabusinessassoc.com. Also, our contact number is 202-288-5660 and 202-903-7278.
Thanks so much, Brother
Aziz.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes.
Brothers and sisters, we're going to continue our discussion this evening on our natural disasters, and we will inform Sister Aisha will be coming on, and she will be informing you on all the information and bringing you up to date on those classes that we're currently having with Black Belt Wall Street. And that is Black Belt Wall Street. Saying that to say, New Africa Business Association, Black Belt Wall Street, is a LLC. It is a for-profit organization. But Black Belt Wall Street, is a non-profit organization. So again, you are talking about two different organizations altogether, even though New Africa Business Association and Black Belt Wall Street LLC is a subsidiary of Black Belt Wall Street. But Black Belt Wall Street is a non-profit organization, and its board of directors are being put together as we speak. So you'll hear very, very much in the future, coming soon, about the incorporation of Black Belt Wall Street. Let me just say, we have the dormant name of Black Belt Wall Street they have two. Had one as a .com and one as an organization. But to be for sure, we paid for and have incorporated both names that are out there that has anything to do with Black Belt Wall Street. So those of you that wish to become members and establish Black Belt Wall Streets in your area, we're looking so forward to helping you to do that. In many cases, you may not even need any help. You already have an organization, but you would like to be under the umbrella of Black Belt Wall Street, because that is our, that's our motivation, is to bring back the old Black Belt Wall Street and the success that the Black Belt Wall Street had, even to the point where it was the Black Belt Wall Street that actually gave the name to the Greenwood business district, and that name was Black Wall Street. So, but much more of that will be spoke upon as Black Belt Wall Street continues to grow. But again, New Africa Business Association and Black Belt Wall Street, LLC, and of course, Black Belt Wall Street stands alone. So with that said, we're going to, but I can tell you this, each will continue to emphasize business growth in the communities. New Africa Business Association, Black Belt Wall Street, yes, we need your memberships to continue operations and the expenses that it costs to get our message across to all of our listeners. So again, welcome to the New Africa Business Association, Black Belt Wall Street, and the coming very soon of Black Belt Wall Street. She's coming back. So with that said, Brother Aziz, any comments that you might have? We got a two-hour show. We're going to sort of generalize as much as we can to give the audience a chance to come on before we bring on our guest speakers, Sister Aisha. So Brother Aziz, any comments, especially about our new, we finally have the Black Belt under our charter.
Well, yeah. A lot of, maybe some of our listeners don't know the reason why we're bringing back the Black Belt Wall Street. And, you know, it's not Black Wall Street. And the reason why it's Black Belt Wall Street is because of the business belt, of business, the area that our African Americans were very successful in businesses in that. And as we know, it was all the way from Texas all the way on up to Maine and throughout the South and on up into the Northeast. And so we know that this event or this happening among our people was at a time, and it was strong, when there was segregation in the community, that we wasn't integrated with other people. And we found it a necessity to do business with one another. Well, a lot of people may think that it's much different than that now, and we're able to do business wherever we want to go and all of that. Then, but in a stark reality, we're not getting the same benefits nor the same deals that we got doing when we had our own, where we were able to not only produce products and put them on the market among our own, but we were able to get products at a price that was just as good as any occasion was able to get them to put in their community, unless they were the producer. And, you know, but we were able to get them as any other buyer out there because you never turn money down, you know. So this is a good time. This is a good time, as Brother Bilal was saying, bringing back the Black Belt Wall Street, that initiative again, to get people more interested in networking again, doing business together, but actually investing in your communities where you live. Putting businesses in those empty storefronts is gone empty. Nobody's there. No business is there. This is a great time in American history to go back and do that. It's almost like the country is almost going into a recycle of what was happening many years ago, almost 100 years ago or more. It's going back into that cycle again, and it should be for the better, and it is for the better, that more and more African Americans are being conscious about doing business together, of doing business. But networking together, that is still something that we have to overcome. So once we're able to network together as we have tried to do businesses as businesses, getting businesses to network, these businesses may be able to help promote or can help promote the community in which they're in to invest not only in their business, but invest in other businesses to bring it to the community, because what it does is it creates jobs in our community. And with those jobs, we know whatever businesses that are there, the money's going to circulate at least one or two times in our community, maybe three, depending on the number of businesses that we have in the community that we need. We got a plenty of food businesses in our communities now, and I'm not saying not to go in them, but we got plenty of those. It's like the Chinese stores in town. You know, you got a number of them. There are other businesses that we need to fulfill in our community other than just food stores all the time. You know, I know a place that I've seen over in a place in D.C., Washington, D.C., in Southeast, on what they call Martin Luther King Avenue. Well, right in a certain area there by the area where there's going to be a big apartment complex going to be built there called the Clara. And it's, the Muslims are doing this here. It's named after in honor of Sister Clara Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's wife. It's a big thing. The whole D.C. government is participating in it. But along that corridor right there, there are now, there are, and has been for a while, you have a community pharmacy and drugstore that's already there, African-American, as well as some other convenience stores there. And with the new building putting in an apartment complex, it's going to even bring more business in the community and businesses that actually are a benefit to the community. So this is what people with foresight and if they're able to motivate their communities are doing. Other businessmen and businesswomen are networking together and coming together and putting their funds together and creating projects in their communities that's not only benefiting the community, benefiting all of us as a whole, to know that we can be able to go around in various communities around the country, because that's the way they have us out there. There's no problem going to any city in America and asking where the African Americans live. We have distinct communities like that all throughout the United States, and that came from segregation many, many years ago. And the only thing lacking in those communities, again, is businesses. As well as, and when we got businesses in there, we can stop that redlining, where people aren't able, not that they don't know, have the money to have home improvements and better their community. It's just that the banks are not loaning our communities money like that because we don't really have a lot of those type of situations, businesses in our community. So this is what Black Belt Wall Street is trying to help promote, is those businesses back into the area. Have people commuting and doing business together, business people sharing business ideas together. We don't want to make this some type of dream. This is a reality, a real reality that a little bit of hard work and we could do it. And it's really not the hard work that's really to be able to do it. It's having the mindset to do it. Once we have that mindset to do it, there's nothing in our way that we can't accomplish or overcome. And again, I refer back to this Sister Claire Muhammad apartment building complex that I know of that's going up in Washington, D.C., and about Muslim community. And they put it up, and it was a matter of the community coming together, and they were able to do it. Another example was a Bible Way church over in Washington, D.C. They build a big, magnificent apartment complex, and it's been there for years. So we have examples out there in the community what we can do. As our motto that was created by Brother Bilal at the start of our business, what one can't do, many can. And that's what we have been promoting and trying to get networking among different African-Americans in businesses and just individuals who are not even in business, coming on the show, listening to the effort that we have, and realize what we're trying to do. And you don't have to have a business to become a member of the New Africa Black Belt Wall Street Business Association. To know what we're doing, to see the effort that we're putting out here, trying to inform our community of what's going on. We know that informing our community what's going on is going to make the community better places to live in. People will know how to go to get the resources that they need to have a better and live a better life. So this is what we constantly work on every week that we come on. And in recent terms, we've been dealing with Sister Aisha Abdul Ali from a company called SummerTech Incorporated, and they have been talking about disaster prevention and preparation. And this is something that is definitely needed. We see what has happened in Kentucky over the last week or so, where the flooding has come in there. The count is up to 30-some dead. They don't know how many, 100 and some are missing. They don't know where they are. And we're talking about massive losses. Homes washed off the mountains and hills. Matter of fact, big structures, not washed off the mountain, washed in the river. Some of them went down in the bottom of the river. They're there. And then some washed on down, and eventually they were broken to pieces and all of that. I mean, all the people's possessions. One thing, if the tornado comes through and tears up and scatters a lot of your home in different areas, you may recover some obstacles. But when your home is washed into a river and then washed away, and you were unfortunate to get out of there with just your clothes on your back and yourself, you've lost everything. So what do you do in a situation like that since you've lost everything? At least you have your life left. And maybe if the community prepare for things like this here, when something come up like this here, we won't be left alone. We won't be out there trying to find out what is our next move. We can prepare the community if these things happen, to know what our next move would be, to know where our food, shelter, and if need be, clothing is going to come from. So these are the type of programs that New Africa Business Black Belt Wall Street Business Association is promoting. And as Brother Bilal has also said again, we're not giving up. We're not giving up. We've been here too long trying to promote this. And we know if what we're saying only falls on a few ears every week, sometimes many ears, we know that there is a blessing in it, because somebody is becoming more aware of the necessity to have business in our community, as well as businesses networking with one another. So, Brother Bilal, that's starting out what I really had to say.
All right, Brother Aziz, appreciate your comments, but I do want to get back to Black Wall Street.
Yeah,
and because being that it's recently incorporated, we can put just too much sometimes on a person's mind. And right now, my biggest emphasis is Black Belt Wall Street. And Black Belt Wall Street, of course, when you're talking about Black Belt Wall Street, you're really going back into a time of really slavery. And that's where the term really, the first term Black Belt Wall Street was really used. And it was used in the part of the country that contained the darkest colored soil. Now, of course, we're talking about areas from Texas, and you start talking about from Texas and coming all the way up south, and every Texas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. So you just finding your way south, but when you start talking about the part of the country that contained the darkest soil, this was the part of the country that contained the highest number of African American slaves. And this is also where the part of the country where America was built. The wealth of America was built in it, and so Black Belt Wall Street, like you said, Brother Aziz, range from Texas at that time all the way to New York City, and the most recognizable community of the Black Belt Wall Street, the most recognizable community was Black Wall Street, and that name came from Black Belt Wall Street, and the money and the power that this country got from African Americans, and how America became so rich, all from the Black Belt, which was no more than slaves. And at that time, most of us was in the South. And we stayed there. But the power of Black Belt, especially from the Greenwood District, now that it's been recognized as Black Wall Street, and the financial powers. And like I said, when you own your own property, you can make your own plans. And being that the Greenwood District of Black Wall Street, financing the Black Belt Wall Street, now you're able to pay off the sharecroppers. And that dark color soil that they've been making so much money from, now that African Americans are able to pay off their contract agreement from sharecropping, they can now start leaving the South, and that started the Great Migration. But before that Great Migration, there were some other tools in there that African Americans were able to use now that they have paid off that debt from the sharecroppers, and the monies that they have now is their monies, or whatever agreement they had with the estate owners, whoever they work for. But I'm saying one of the tools that was used at the time for the Great Migration was Henry Ford. Henry Ford, at just about the time that Wall Street was able to grow in so many different areas in the South, Henry Ford had built that Model T Ford. And at that time, he bought Model T Ford for $100 brand new. But $100 was a lot of monies back in those days. And this was the early 30s. And $100 was quite a bit of money. But about 3 years of the Model T being built, those who bought the cars new was now wanting new cars, wanting updated cars. And this is where the used car market came into play. And when the used car market came into play, now you could get a Model T Ford about 3 years old. You might, rather than $100, you might pay $50 or $25. Getting down into the brothers and sisters range. And they did. That's why you see pictures and you see these old Model T Fords, and they would have them stacked up to the roof, packing their stuff, moving from the South. But so that was one of the tools that we had, because we was able now to buy that old Model T Ford. And so this was, again, this is the power of the Black Belt Wall Street. And of course, like I said, the most popular community from the Black Belt Wall Street was the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So brothers and sisters, that's the power of the black dollar, and is that we have built this country. So now you can see the power of your own efforts. If you would start now to redo what our past history has done. And another thing, that past history where we were now, the dollar bill was staying in our community about 40 months before it left. And the wealth was building in all African-American communities. This was even after the destruction of one of our most prestigious communities. And that most privileged community was Black Belt Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That community was destroyed. But our other communities was not destroyed. Remember, Black Belt Wall Street ranged from Texas all the way to New York. And so also the Black Belt was still in power. And the black communities were still growing up until what time? Up until 1965. What happened in 1965, what destroyed the black belt, was integration. We ourselves decided to stop doing what we was successfully doing in our communities and integrate to what we thought was going to be a better community by going to the other side of the track, the Caucasian side of the track. And today, that's where most of us are still living, and that's where our biggest amount of poverty, red infested everything, streets, everything you go, the rats are right there following you, and these were so-called ghettos that we are living in by going to the other side of the track. No, the black belt is telling you to go back home. Go back home and when I say go back home, because that's where you can still can afford land. That's where you can still afford houses. So that migration we made to the north, it's time to now to migrate back to the south as quick as we possibly can. Because again, that's where our homes and it's affordable for us to go back to our homes.
Yes.
And build. And most
That's
of
right.
you already have nice buildings in your homes, beautiful homes, but you do not have any businesses in your community. That means that your beautiful home is no more than a ghost town, and you cannot get equity values from a ghost town. You must have commerce in order to create values in your communities. So again, brothers and sisters, like Brother Harris would tell you, it is time for us to put our monies together and buy entire blocks, especially blocks where the community has been abandoned. Usually Caucasian communities, they abandon many of the communities where we was, I was raised, and they go and build off somewhere to a new community where they try to keep their segregation going. Let them go ahead on out there and do so. But the communities that they left, it's time for us to own those communities and buy up the blocks, just like we're doing down in Selma, Alabama. And see, that's the Black Belt. That's how I saw it. I know that Brother Aziz, you're right, what's happening here in Washington, D.C., that's all fine and good, but the Black Belt didn't do that. The Black Belt is the Black Belt we're talking about, but the Black Belt is buying down in Selma, Alabama. The Black Belt has a business, a program right now that's being presented to them. I don't think we're going to lose it. That is going on right now in Florida. Beautiful.
Community.
That is being African Americans own it. They want to sell it to us. But we have to come up with the approaches and price, and we have to do it soon. We don't have the community as to where we can get together and we can collectively put together $1 million just like that. But other communities do have that kind of buying power. They have they can put together tens of millions of dollars because they have investors from their communities. And those communities is what's going to be buying up. They're already buying up the Black communities. Right here in Washington, D.C., I don't even think there's such thing as a Black community anymore. I done gone over into some of the places we used to call the hood. Ain't no hoods anymore. You got condominiums,
right.
But it costs you $1 million, and you don't see you don't see us hanging around in our own old neighborhoods anymore. We've been priced out. So again, that's why I am saying that integration was a bad investment for us right from the start, and you can prove it. How can you prove it? You go back and look at the history books, and history says that during the time of segregation, we was more prosperous as far as a community of money and equity and values than at any time in history. It was the Black Belt that started Marcus Garvey. And the Marcus Garvey, the huge movement of Marcus Garvey, all of those monies came from the power of the Black Belt. It was the Black Belt that started the Nation of Islam. It was the Black Belt that the Cotton Club and many insurance companies, banks, all of it was created by the power of the Black Belt. But the power of the Black Belt is no more than you and I, brothers and sisters. That's the success, like I said, that we've already had. But that success is also is the reason why Brother Aziz mentioned a few moments ago something about redlining. Redlining has been around now for just about 100 years, and it's still just as efficient, and I'm sorry, it's still just as damaging to our community today as it was 100 years ago. But again, no one, I don't see Biden and no one at all talking about getting rid of redlining. And it was the federal government that started, so they know about its existence, and they know this is why there's no money going today in the African-American community. Not one bank nowhere can we send our money to go in and exchange monies, even though we make deposits in the bank. But where is those deposits coming back to our community? It just don't happen. So again, racial discrimination, racial discrimination, it ain't nothing but modern slavery. So slavery is always going on in this country, and it's still going on today. But brothers and sisters, you and I, we're spending more than $1.7 trillion out here to other communities, where other communities ain't spending a dime to your community. Why not spend that money in your own community and bring back the power of the black belt? So again, like I said, the black belt has incorporated itself. We're here to stay. So again, we will be giving you much more information on how you can become members and be participants with the Black Belt Wall Street. And like I said, Black Belt Wall Street stands on its own. It has no affiliation with anyone else. It's a nonprofit organization. It's Black Belt Wall Street. So with that said, like I said, we take the first part of our shows because we are a business association. And now we're going to start, I'm going to turn over to an expert who can talk about disaster and the preparations and the trainings that we all need. So with that said, Brother Aziz, I welcome your comments, but at this time I'm going to turn it over to our expert. Sister Aisha, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Good evening, As-salamu alaykum. How are you doing?
Good evening. As-salamu alaykum.
Yes, wa alaykum as-salam. Thank you both.
Yes, ma'am. Well, we're going
go
to
right ahead.
I could say we just finished our business conversation, and we're going to now turn it over to Sister Aisha.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon or good evening to our listening audience. And hopefully tonight we can have a dialogue about climate change. I would like to hear your comments, and I would like for you to educate me further on what we can do to get our communities involved in climate change. But before we go to climate change, I just want to let the audience and Brother Bilal and Brother Aziz know that I live in a community in North Carolina. It's called Durham, and many of you have heard of that. In Durham, we have the headquarters of North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company and also Mechanics and Farmers Banks and various savings institutions. And these were great financial institutions in the early days in the 60s and further back. And they are struggling to survive now. And this was considered part of Black Wall Street in the sense that we had the segregated six-story hospital that performed surgery. We had the university, North Carolina College, at that time. And all of these institutions sustained us, and our money was able to turn over in our community repeatedly before it left, and we were able to build these institutions. But now our dollar only stays in our community 6 hours before it moves into the other communities for the other services. And that 6 hours is primarily in the beauty salons and the barbershops. So we are thankful for those institutions, but we would like to see our dollar circulating for many days in our community, just like the other communities. So with that said, I would like to talk about the training that is offered, and we are putting out the schedule for August and September in a few days.
Sister Aisha, please.
Yes. Yes.
Being that you brought that banking situation up and give the scenario that you just gave, I have to ask a couple questions. Because,
sure.
Number one, I sort of heard of that bank, and I'm not for sure if I'm certain if I'm right or wrong, but it looked like I've sort of heard of the bank because of its old history name. Now, my question
yeah.
is this. If such a bank have always existed and is still existing, why hasn't our communities know something about these banks? Why haven't these banks made themselves available to the black community? And I know you may not have the answer to that, but if you have comments on it, I certainly welcome your comments or anyone else's comments.
Absolutely. Well, let me give my comment based on my knowledge. The bank, the Mechanics and Farmers Bank, grew up, developed into a large system. They had branches in many cities in North Carolina. And over the years, a lot of the support that the banks gave to the community was through the religious institutions. And it seems like over the years, that support began to dwindle. In 2021, North Carolina Mechanics and Farmers Bank changed its name to, and it also hired its first white president of the bank in the history of the company. And now we seldom hear anything about the bank other than it's open, it's been remodeled, at least the headquarters is in Durham along with a couple of branches in Greensboro, a branch in Raleigh, and other cities. We hear very little about it. But we do know that that banking system, when we had the large banking financial debacle in the U.S. a few years ago, that was one banking system that remained solvent. And it did not suffer greatly like many other larger banks that actually went out of existence. And so it seems like their directions have changed a great deal. They don't have the level of depositors. We're to blame for that also because we aren't putting our money in the black bank.
You want to know something? From the description
yes.
that you give, starting with the fact that they was controlled by the religious, I'm saying I use the word controlled, because, again, you see, and that happens, and I've said it so many times, when it comes to the monies that go through the churches, the pastors or whoever think they own the church, they cannot spend that amount of money that come through that church themselves. They need a bank. But at the same time, if I am going to put that kind of monies in your bank, I want certain control of this and that. I don't care whether I am the pastor or whether I'm the white man. there are certain things that I want, and when I start wanting things, it takes away from serving the general public. And so, again, I heard two things, the control first by a religious organization, and later on, I know what has happened there when you said white president, they sold out. Someone has bought their franchise. That's why the white man is the president, because the white man is the owner now. The residuals of that have stopped money's flow from going into, again, the black communities. And a matter of fact, that started slowing down with those pastors. But when they sold out, that really, because you don't know what direction the bank wants to go. You know, you got financial institutions out here that wants to take a loss for tax write-offs. Some of the bigger corporations. So they may buy a small one, and that small one don't have to be as, the liquidity don't have to be as great as for them, because they may want to use that as some sort of tax write-off or something. But again, I can see why the communities, because the bank is no longer a part of that black community. That's why I was saying, because there's no such thing as I can't believe that African Americans, if they had a bank right in their own black community, they wouldn't make their deposits right in that bank right there in their communities.
Yeah. Well, they African Americans certainly did, actually. And we do know that 5 years ago, maybe a little longer, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, and many of you have heard of that.
It was sold out years ago.
Yes.
See, that's what I mean that's what I mean about ownership. When you don't own your own businesses, then someone else is controlling your communities and controlling all of those in the communities. And so, yes, they offer you a black a financial institution like North Carolina Mutual or somebody over here is $1 billion. And, the presidents and the board of directors that own that black own that company, they're going to take $1 million. And because it's the easy way out. It's easy for me to go ahead and strike it rich and say, forget about the community, rather than me having this. Because if I serve the community there, I got to work 8 hours a day and year after year after year. So it's unfortunate, but at the same time, that is a perfect example as why African Americans, and I keep saying again and again, our biggest deposits is in those doggone churches. And we got, if the churches would just take the monies and grow their communities, I wouldn't have no problem with the church. But this thing about the church saying, I own all the monies. Where did they earn it? How can you earn money with somebody donating and giving it to charity? Charity is to build communities. It's not just to give somebody some money saying, I collected $10,000 and I'm going to give $100 to the charity and I'm going to keep the other $9,999. I'll keep that. No. Monies belong to the communities, and it's to grow your communities. And so again, yes, the monies that come into the banks, those pastors can't spend it all, but they can't. And I know this for a fact because I done talked to the banks that follows the S&P. And I've already had a conversation with them because the same question I just imposed to you, I imposed to the S&P and all those bankers that follows them. I asked them the same thing. Where is the black man's money? Because so much of it is going into your banks. And they never answered that question. Matter of fact, they wanted to talk to me in private about it, but I refused. I told them it was an open, they had an open forum, and I feel like my question was asked in an open forum, and it should be answered in an open forum, not behind you gonna call me in the office. But they, to make a long story short, they told me and those who are served with the New Africa Business Association, they told us, they said, we're going to tell you anyway. And this was after they took a lunch break and everybody had left. And they said, because we're not going back up on the stage. He said, the reason that the monies that we have in come back to the church deposit, he said, yes, those monies come into our banks. He said, no, and we asked the chaplains, the ministers who made the deposit, what you want to do with the monies? What do you want done? And the chaplains, he said, and those bankers told me, they said, out of all of those black pastors, and he pointed them out, he said, none of them have ever asked for any monies for the community. They come in here and take millions of dollars out of their accounts, but they've never said anything about this deposit. It's for the communities. It's always been they're taking money just themselves and doing whatever they want to do. But and this is the truth. And that's he said, so again, as far as you guys blaming us, calling us white supremacists because they were Republicans. And he said, calling us white supremacists. He said, he pointed them out because they had the pastors in the room. He said, ask them. And we walked on out. We walked on out because we knew it was useless to ask those black pastors. You know, they wasn't going to answer us anyway. So that's the situation.
That's sad.
It's extremely sad. So again, that's why we have such a problem with money. When you start talking about a community become vested with each other and start pooling their monies together like other groups, other communities, that's why we have a problem, because those that we entrust with our deposits, look what they're doing with it, and look how lavish they live. You know, and this, you know, so again, this money's, if that money was going to grow in the community, we would have our banks back, we would have our insurance companies back, we would have a cash flow for the communities to do just what Black Belt did, pay off your debts, and pay them back. And that's how they made money. They lent money to the black community. The black community paid them back. And that's how the cash was able to stay in your communities, because the institutions where you're putting your monies in is giving these monies back to the communities in kind. And everybody is doing business with each other because, again, we have a cash flow. So, again, but you brought that up, and I mean it took me right on off into that particular conversation.
Brother Bilal, I wanted to make a statement that the bank that Sister Aisha was talking about, that bank went into receivership in 2018, something like that, 19, they were saying that the end was near. That it's gonna, the end is near.
Yeah,
went into receivership and it's about ready to go.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they said they have over $167 million in assets, but
Where did it go? Where did it go?
I don't know. They that's why they're going into receivership and that.
No, they didn't tell you where it went. They just said, yeah, they have a lot of money. They sold out. Everybody grabbed their piece and ran.
Right. Yeah, that's what it's more or less saying. That they didn't say it wasn't like, because they didn't sell stock or nothing like that. It was a privately owned company.
No, they could have. They like I said, they sold out.
And just sometimes, I guess that's what happened. People just sell out. They sold it out to a bigger company,
Hell yeah. Well, that's, of course, bigger company. Bigger company might have, like I said, all kinds of use
But they still, right now, they're still carrying the same history and everything about it. But, you know, they're saying it's in receivership, so. And that the end was close, so.
Yeah.
Once they work out the matters there,
but
you know,
The thing about it, now when the federal government sends back money to the community where the deposit came from, because the money commission exchanger at the Federal Reserve, they have to send back, after monies have been cleared through the Federal Reserve, now the Exchange Commission have to send back those deposits that was made from whatever community it was made from. The black
community
cannot come back to the back because we don't have nowhere to receive our deposits. That's what happens when you don't have the money. So your deposits go into the white community. When you put your monies in the bank, and the bank comes back, all that money is being loaned to white folks in the production of the white community. Remember, they got red lines against the black community, so the bank don't even consider the black community. But it's your money that's in there.
Well, you know, it's changing that mindset.
You're paying these folks to discriminate against you. Brothers and sisters, that's why you got to make your own business plans. When you let somebody else make them, especially against you as an African-American, brother, they're going to put the screws to you.
You know, if we could get the African-American churches to deposit their monies in one bank.
Our problems would end in a month.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's getting them to do that.
Oh, no, you ain't going to get them to agree. You talking about, now you joking? You talking about getting Satan to become a believer.
Right. You know, wanting jets. You know, things like that to fly around the country.
That's what I'm saying. They own the church, man. They got 50,000 members.
You know, we got churches around the area. I imagine just like some other ones that have over 5,000. Members, 10,000 members. My godson goes to a church, 5,000 members.
At least, can you visualize if you did a 50-mile circular radius? I repeat, a 50-mile circular radius of Washington, D.C. 50 miles, and you go do a circular radius. How, and you look at all the black churches, You're talking about Baltimore, Annapolis, all of Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Washington. Brother, do you see how much money that is? Weekly?
Brother, in Washington Informer that comes out in the week, you know, the one, the free one at the newsstand, it has over 50-some churches in there, brother, that's advertising that thing. You know, I don't know what they pay to advertise it. Because
look at that cash flows. That's the black dollars going into the church. And I'm wondering, what do you think? I'm not gonna get. I'm gonna leave it alone.
That same paper where they advertise in every week, and then Washington Informer. That's owned by, you know, Brother Rolock. Well, his daughter, Denise Rolock.
Your problems would be solved. If we did the right thing, if the African Americans did the right thing with their charitable deposits, and we would be financially able to bring back the businesses as to where now we can have business operations as to where now we don't have to go on the outside for capital at all. It's all right here in our community.
That's right. We can do that.
We have the money, but we have that division. And that division has been there for a long, long time. But can you blame the community when there's nothing ethical about the institutions that you put your trust in?
Yeah, that's one of the things. Being able to go to some of these African-American banks and get money, get some loans from them. As any other bank, they go by certain principles and things. So if your credit is no good and all that, no matter what bank you go to, you're going to have problems.
Again,
one of the things a lot of our people ignore, having good credit. All of these things are things that we need to help the people, inform them about having better credit to qualify.
Sister Ashley, we didn't mean to take, I know, like I said, I thought we were going to leave business alone. But
well,
as you can see, it all goes back business.
It certainly does. And one of the issues that we have by not being prepared for natural disaster is that we don't have the financial resources to come back, to bounce back. And that affects our sustainability for the future. I was reading over the week how several reports have come out to say that in the time of a natural disaster, you need to have cash. Because in most cases, if the power is off or if the towers are down, you can't use your ATM card.
Okay. Yep,
and so
right.
you need to have available cash to move about and to buy food or even to buy gas if you have to evacuate. And very few Americans have available cash. Very few Americans have even an emergency savings put aside. But these are essentials. They are just as essential, not mandatory, like home insurance to get a mortgage, but it's essential that you have cash set aside when there isn't a disaster, because many places will not and cannot take your debit card. So that was the point that I wanted to make, but let's talk about the overall training. and the objective of the training. And I would like to for you all to be thinking how we can bring more people, or why more people, not just the listening audience, but also throughout America, why 70 to 80% of minorities are unprepared for a disaster. Why do you think that is the case when everybody hears it, everybody sees it, you see the storm is all over the news? So that's a question that I would like to come back to. But first, let me tell you about the objectives of the training. The number one objective is to equip our families and communities with the essential skills that can make the difference between surviving the storm or total devastation. And that's a reality, because you are seeing it on national television, and you are experiencing this heat dome that's affecting many people's health. Another objective is to empower you to take immediate action for your survival, the survival of your family, and for your community. And there are some things that you can do to help your community and help your family survive a disaster. If you do nothing, just remember, you're setting yourself up for devastation. But there are some things that are within your power that you can do. And the last objective is to just give you one less problem to worry about. And the reason we put that objective in there is because the health industry is telling us that people are stressed. People are stressed to the point where it is affecting their mental health and their physical health. It's actually breaking down the resolve of individuals to move forward, and depression is on an upswing. So if we can give you one less problem to worry about, and that is through the process of preparedness, you feel empowered because you know you have done something. You have put a plan in place on what to do when the disaster comes. And so you don't feel powerless, and you don't feel that you are jeopardizing your health. So this is the purpose of the training. So to our listening audience and to all of us, I would like to ask this question. Why do you think 70 to 80% of minorities are unprepared for a disaster in the United States of America? Can someone respond to that question so we can have some dialogue?
Our mics are open, so if you can hear us, we can certainly now hear you. So our mics are open. We welcome your comments or questions.
And if your response is not about the 70 to 80% of minorities who are unprepared, let the response be about why are you unprepared, if you are in that category of being unprepared. Why is it that you are?
I know of the question you're asking. I was watching the news last night, and the same FEMA is just about asking the same questions that you are asking the audience, and you have been asking. And even with your teachers, they've been saying the same thing about having survivor's kits, and by having that you are constantly teaching us, the professionals, professionals of FEMA, like I said, and I've noticed that not only FEMA, but I've heard several. Sometimes I think these folks are actually listening to us, because so much of
maybe
what you're talking about, is so much like what they're like giving me, I would say, verification on TV. So no one. So the question you're asking, I don't even know if anyone is, and like I said, our mics are open, but in my opinion, I think that not only you, but like I said, FEMA realizes that no one has no idea what to do. And that's why I think you see these sad situations that is being shown to us right now with folks who, like they said, we don't have nothing. Our homes have been swept away. Only thing we have is our life. And we're witnessing that right now. They have no idea what to do. And this is America. And we're into some serious disasters, in my belief, that are about to come. But what to do? I don't think they have no idea. And that's why I'm hoping that they learn as much as they can on what you're trying to provide. So if that, and that's not the answer to the question, but that's just my opinion and my observation.
What about anyone else that's listening have any idea? Or are you even conscious? Go ahead.
My opinion is, I believe that, especially in our community, we're dependent on the government. You know, what they're going to do, we need this, we need that, what they're going to do. And I think a lot of people depend on the government. They think that the government is going to come to their aid and help them, and they don't have to be prepared for this. It's like, you know, they're going to give me help. What are they going to do? You're in this situation, you're going to say, what are they going to do? I need help. So I believe, I just think that a lot of people are depending on the government to come to the rescue when they can do things themselves to prevent that, or at least be prepared to where if the government comes, you know, hey, great to see you, but at least we've prepared ourselves for something like this. So that's what I think, Sister Aisha.
And, you know, and I believe that also. One of the things that we must remember, and we use the Katrina incident as a awakening call, it took the federal government 72 hours. That's where we get our 72-hour rule in everything now as it relates to disaster. It took 3 days for FEMA to rescue the people. Many people did not have food. They did not have clean water, and many of them lost their lives waiting for that, for the federal government to come. But the reality is this. If everybody waited for the federal government, the resources of the federal government will be exhausted. And the federal government are not coming across town. That's not their first stop. They are going on the other side of town first to make sure that group is sufficient. By the time they get across town to us, their resources have dwindled. And they don't have the capacity to send us to shelters, temporary shelters, and then long-term shelters. Those resources have dwindled. And so I think that it's easy to just be afraid and just put it out of your mind until it's on your doorstep. But when it's on your, the storm is on your doorstep, it's too late. It's too late for you to evacuate. It's too late for you to think about sheltering in place if you don't have the supplies to do so. So you have put your family at risk. And this is something that the head of our households, we've got to think. And I have to mention this. The storms are going to continue to come throughout all of the religious texts. We are told about the storms of the past and the storms of the future. And if we are people of faith, we must take this serious. This is not just something that's being told to us that's not going to happen, because it is happening, and it did happen. So I'm constantly saying to the people in my faith group, wake up. Teach the people to become conscious, consciously aware of the coming disasters. And and I would think that all of the religious groups will mold this teaching into their text on spirituality, on being God-fearing. How can we not do this when it is in our faith every day and our scriptures tell us about it constantly, constantly? It's like we have blinders on and we just are too afraid to admit the reality of what we are actually seeing. So if anyone have any comments, please bring it out. Let's talk about it. We plan to go to the churches. We plan to go to the masjids and the synagogues and say the same thing. How can you not talk to your people about becoming prepared? And I have to say, one of the reasons, and I was asked this question, why am I so passionate about preparedness? And why am I not working with recovery? Because I'm FEMA certified in both areas. I chose to limit myself to preparedness because of my experience. I grew up in Western North Carolina, if any of you are familiar with this, and you've heard, some of you have heard this story before. Every year we had a major storm, and that storm was called winter. It was frigid cold. It was blizzard-like conditions. Snow on the ground up to my knees, and remember, I was a kid too, up to my knees and my thighs for 3 and 4 months. We had extremely cold weather. We had no services from the city because it was during a time of segregation. We had to freeze our water. Our water froze in our houses, in our faucets, for up to 3 months. So we had to preserve water. We had to preserve and can all of our food. We had to, after the storm, after winter, we had spring. In the springtime, we assessed the damage from the winter. We had a very short spring, maybe 1.5 months. After the spring, we had summer, which was longer. We had to, everything that we assessed from the spring, we had to take care of it in the summer months. In the fall, we had to look back and make sure, do we have this? Did we board up this house? Did we put a new roof on this house? And we're talking about the entire community because we had segregated communities. And so the men and the women, we worked every day, 7 days a week, to get ready and the little children, because I was a small kid, but I had duties. And I can remember when I was 5 years old, I had certain duties in that preparation. So we worked every month of the year to prepare for the storm, and that storm was winter. Some of the people lost their lives. Other people lost their houses because, you know, in the segregated community, we were in a flood zone. And some of the elderly people, they couldn't survive. And we buried them. We found them dead during the winter, during the storm. The men did, found them. And they had to preserve their body, freeze their bodies in a certain place that was designated for that so we could bury them in the spring. So my entire life, early life, was based on preparedness. And that's the way I live even today. I still can. And my children ask me, Mama, why are you canning up this food? And I simply say, because I don't want to lose that skill, and I want you all to understand how to do that.
That's
so
right.
That's why I'm passionate about this. And I know preparedness works. It is essential. And if you don't do it, you're going to be in trouble when the storm comes. And you might very well lose your life or the life of some of your family members or your neighbors. And so there is no doubt about it. It does work. So we as a people, we're going to have to get into this. We're going to have to change our mindset. We're going to have to adapt to a new way of life. And sometimes adaptation is difficult. But it is going to be more difficult if we don't know how to do it. And that's what training is, to teach you how to adapt. And there's no question about it. We can't live the way we have been living. We have to change some things. And this is what we would like for, you know, to bring forward to our community and to all communities. So I'll still take your questions. Any questions?
Our mics are open. Our mics are open.
And
we welcome your questions.
And
just
all
like,
questions are good
just
questions.
Like, just
like
yeah. I would make a comment. You know, you took me back. Don't believe, you know, when you talk about being out there in that ice and snow and up to your knees and all, you ain't done nothing but took me back.
Really?
I know exactly what you're talking about. But you know, sister, those times are the times that you think back that, you know, we were survivors. We were survivors. And because we had to be survivors, this disaster that you're talking about, most of us who were and have gone through being a survivors and made ourselves self-sufficient because we used everything that Almighty God provided for us. We found some way of using it before the disaster came. When you start talking about gardening and planting big gardens and harvesting your gardens at harvesting times and after you harvest the work, and this is what communities did. They would all
yeah.
come together with their bushes and bushel baskets
yep.
of everything.
Yep.
You
That's
everybody
true.
Everybody would have a bushy basket right there in front of them doing something as far as harvesting
mm-hmm.
it for another
right.
time. And with our smoke houses, knowing how to put your meats away as to where they could be stored for a long period of time. You see, this is things that African Americans not only are new to survivor, but we talk. This is what I mean about African Americans making America rich. There were so many things that we did that bought on a value to this country. And so now that I look back and I look at these disasters we're going through and the after effects, and I know, like I said, we don't get with the after, but the after effects, many of us, when there's devastation, we can survive because we know something about surviving and disruption. Because those of us who came up during those hard times of segregation, we had no other choice. But
yep,
it has taught us to be ahead of the game. That disaster should come on us, because but like you said, Sister Aisha, this is those of us who are senior citizens now. My fear is that the ones who not baby boomers, so to speak, what is that generation after us? And the generation
the millennials.
After,
the millennials?
Yes. What in the world if they don't get the teachings from us while we're trying to give it to them? You know, I just perishing and stuff like that is something that I just hate to visualize. But that's
well, you know, interesting enough, the most prepared group in America are the Gen Zs, and they are the 25 to 35 group. And that's the group that call themselves the survivalists. And they have, it's a club for them. They have a club mentality and a groupie mentality. But they are 80% prepared for a disaster. They are the mountain climbers in that group. But they are prepared. But they are not community focused. They are individual and club focused. So, and they're the ones that spend their money on the new fad for disaster preparedness. And they know how to survive because they call themselves the survivalists, and they go on these great retreats in the mountains and do all of this stuff. But that's not the majority of us. The baby boomers and the millennials, the baby boomers have one of the largest income markets, and the baby boomers are not prepared. They really are not. The millennials are not prepared. And these are two categories that have a high education level, but they are not prepared. They have the income, but they are not prepared, you know. And these are groups that we have got to, if we don't get that millennial group to wake up, their children will not be able to make it into the future. And so what we are dealing with now, we are working to survive as a human race. And it's not just in America. This is globally.
Yes,
we
yes.
are rushing as a people to survive as a human race. And
yeah.
if we drag our feet, there is nobody going to come to save us because we have had the opportunity and the time to get ready.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So if any of the audience have questions or comments, please, we certainly welcome your questions and comments because what you have to say help us to get better at what we do. Okay. And we would love to hear from you.
You know, it's just nice.
It's just
we don't have
yes.
the biggest audience tonight.
Okay.
But, you know, I noticed that it's a quiet night. And
all right.
As a matter of fact, I think what whatever, maybe it's time, maybe we're just going through our closing because
okay.
our participating call-ins, although we don't know what's on our internet, but we always go by our show as far as the ones that are actually on with us live, and we don't see that many live participation. So,
well, by the grace of God, we'll be back here Wednesday night. Doing the same thing.
Be doing the same
no.
thing. Exactly right. And I know you were going to do scheduling. You're going to do that on the next show.
Yes. We'll have the schedule. You'll have the schedule hopefully before the week is out, if not the weekend.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes,
well,
for August and September.
In that case, sister, we're going to ask the audience if anybody have any questions, any comments that they would like to make before we close out. We certainly welcome your comments. If not, then we're going to go ahead and close out. Brother Aziz, you have any comments you want to make before closing? Look like he's going in and out. So we're going to say good night, Sister Aisha. And we'll be back next
All right,
week.
Good night. All right. Shalom alaikum, my brother.